Hello and welcome to this, the concluding part of my interview with Alex Kalinikos, about his recent book, Bonfire of Illusions. In part one, we spoke about the first of the twin crises Alex identified as presenting a serious challenge to the neoliberal capitalist world order in 2008. In this second part, we turn to geopolitics, and an event which many in the West may by now have forgotten about, the brief war between Georgia and Russia in the summer of 2008. Be that as it may, Alex Kalinikos places considerable emphasis on its symbolic significance in his argument. I asked him why.
Well, I don't think that it's as important as, say, the wars in Iraq or Afghanistan. It was in a certain sense a relatively minor skirmish, but it was significant, partly for the reasons that I was saying earlier. I mean, let me make it clear. I don't think that Vladimir Putin is a nice or admirable person, and I think his regime, and he and Medvedev preside over is a very unattractive one. But nevertheless, the Russian political elite have got quite a reasonable beef about how the United States has treated them since the end of the Cold War, and in particular the way in which NATO expansion has been used essentially to encircle Russia with Western aligned states. So, as I already said, part of the significance of the war was the Russians saying, we're not going to allow this. But I think it's of a somewhat broader significance as well, because part of the kind of standard narrative of the post-1989 era has been big interstate wars are over. Of course, we still live in a very dangerous era, but it's one in which the kind of wars we're going to wage in are asymmetric wars in which high-tech armies confront low-tech guerrillas, and in which allegedly non-state organizations such as Al-Qaeda represent the main challenge, the main threat, particularly to the Western liberal order. From that perspective, the Russian and Georgian war was interesting because here was a state of, in lots of ways, a very traditional sort, namely Russia, saying, we're not prepared to allow this to happen. And I think it's an augury of a much more extended phenomenon, which is going to be that the United States, whose economic position was already weakening before the financial crisis, and which has been further weakened by that crisis, confronting other states in the world that are no longer prepared to take US hegemony for granted. So I would say the Russian-Georgian war is much less important than the other event of late 2008 that I highlighted, which was the collapse of Lehman Brothers. But it's a harbinger of conflicts to come.
And it does point up how overstretched the American imperium is with Iraq and Afghanistan, and therefore unable really to intervene all around the world.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. One factor that allowed the Russians to flex their muscles so confidently was the knowledge that the US was then too tied up in Iraq and Afghanistan to be able to seriously contemplate doing anything about it. And that situation remains unchanged, even if the US has is running down its commitments in Iraq. It's increased those in Afghanistan. And from the point of view of anyone hostile to American interests, this is a very good situation, because the US has chosen to get entangled in unwinnable counterinsurgency wars.
But the picture that you draw of the potential future is not one of a Cold War Mark II, but a much more multipolar, fluid, and potentially volatile world.
Sure, absolutely. Because if we look at the so-called rising powers, and I think there's an enormous amount of hype, and one has to be put what's happening in perspective. But nevertheless, if we look at the so-called rising powers, China, India, Brazil, and so on, all are much less integrated into the US network of alliances than most other states of any significance, certainly the states of the European Union, for example. And they're clearly not predisposed to automatically follow Washington's lead. Let me give Brazil as an example. Lula the Brazilian president, although he'll soon be out of office, has been in many ways a very Western, you know, attractive ruler of Brazil from the point of view of the West, economically orthodox and so on. But in all sorts of ways, he's blunted US initiatives in Latin America. And also recently, with the Turkish government, he made quite a sort of spectacular démarche, whose aim was to prevent the imposition of tighter sanctions on Iran, which is a major objective of the Obama administration. So the states that are becoming more powerful aren't necessarily ones that are integrated into the kind of framework through which the US has been able to mobilize the most powerful other states in the world, because that's an important ingredient to American success since the Second World War has been its skills in building institutions that integrate other leading states. A lot of the problem with the Soviet Union was that it wasn't integrable in the way that the states of Western Europe or Japan were. Now we're seeing states that are much less integrated and may not want to become more integrated, are getting more pull.
So one potential role for the United States in the future is as honest broker in various regional situations. I mean, how much of that is just really a cloak to hide or to conceal or put a brave face on, sort of managed decline?
I think it's not such a defeatist approach as that. I think it's a way of maintaining primacy. For example, there's been quite a lot of attention given to a speech that Hillary Clinton made recently, the US Secretary of State, where she asserted the US interest in helping other states to deal with the territorial claims that China has in the South China Sea, which is an important area involving a number of other states. There's, you know, the potential, you know, there's oil and other stuff in those seas, which make them economically attractive. And China's recently upgraded its territorial claims in that area. What Clinton was doing was sending a signal that the US wasn't simply challenging China's claims, but more, slightly more subtly, was making itself the orchestrator of a response by the other states in the region. It's interesting and ironic that one of the most vocal in seizing on this initiative was Vietnam, which is an old enemy of the United States, but also of China, and China is closer.
You mentioned at one point Wittgenstein's duck rabbit, a figure which can appear to some eyes as a duck and to some as a rabbit, and you compare that to America's position, which may be hegemony or maybe precariousness. And I wondered in that context, how easy you think it will be for the United States in that sort of polyvalent state to cope with the rise of China. I mean, you talk about potential serious hazards, you know, even a military clash, coping with the rise of China.
It's a very complex situation, partly because the two states are economically interdependent. China both sells the US vast quantities of manufactured goods, but also lends the US the money to buy them with, which is a bizarre situation, which personally I think is unlikely to change very significantly in the short to medium term. It isn't really a matter of whether the Chinese leadership want to challenge the United States. I mean, I think they do, but they want to do it gradually and carefully and in a piecemeal kind of way. It's more simply by virtue of China's rise, it rejigs the relationships in the world. So lots of states in the Third World that since the end of the Cold War had been stuck with accepting whatever the US and its closely allied institutions like the World Bank told them that they had to do, now have options, because there's China with lots of money investing in their countries and buying their raw materials and so on and so forth. I think the US has significant cards in its hand, though. One is, and it was implicit in what I was saying about the South China Sea, is lots of states in the area are scared of China. And in that kind of situation, they can either align with China or they can start, as the technical jargon has it, balancing against China. And the US is making itself available for more or less subtle balancing against China. This is the route for a much closer relationship between the US and India, something that the Bush administration pioneered, but which Obama has retreated a bit from. But there's whatever the policy emphasis of particular administrations, the US and India have a common interest in containing China.
An issue which you mentioned at the beginning of the book and again at the end, which seemed to me of critical importance, was climate change. Yep. And it seemed to me that while we're worrying about bank regulation and shifts in the geopolitical order, the climate, meanwhile, is changing. Yep. And the clock is ticking. And this whole crisis, which started in 2008, really has diverted attention in a fairly significant way, away from concerted action against climate change.
Yeah, and it's a criticism that some people have made of the book, that it didn't discuss climate change enough. My answer to that is that it was a short and focused book. And even so, I managed to draw in quite a lot of stuff. So, but nevertheless, I think there is a very important way in which climate change is connected to what we've been discussing. Because it seems to me that what's common to both the economic crisis and the geopolitical conflict that we've been talking about is essentially a blind process of competition, in which the actors, whether they're firms or whether they're states, are concerned primarily with maximizing their advantage against their rivals, rather than and there's the absence of any mechanism that compels the individual actors to worry about where the whole system, whether economic or geopolitical, is going. Now, exactly the same logic is operative when it comes to climate change. It's been very clear, for example, in the response to the Stern report of whenever it was, 2008, which was a very moderate, mainstream kind of report that said that climate change could be, at least if not avoided completely, chaotic climate change. It could be mitigated by spending the equivalent of 1% of global GDP a year. And then there was a huge hullabaloo from business quarters saying, well, that's much, much too much money. I mean, at one level, it's completely ridiculous when you think of, you know, the amount of money that's spent on cosmetics and things like that. But the problem is, given the kind of logic of competition that drives the world as it's currently constituted, each actor is thinking about it having to bear costs where its rivals don't. And we can see that, for example, in the kind of vacillations of the European Union, should it adopt ambitious targets for CO2 reductions, which are kind of dictated by, well, a moderate compared to what's needed really to prevent a chaotic climate change, or should they go for much more moderate targets, which won't competitively disadvantage European firms? And that logic was very visible in Copenhagen, where essentially you had a number of the big actors, and it was very interesting to see the way it was the US, China, India, Brazil, and South Africa that kind of cut the final deal, essentially decided to sabotage any serious agreement with real targets and so on, because of the kind of constraint that it would put on their competitiveness. So although the book doesn't discuss climate change very much, the underlying systemic logic, whose consequences it addresses when it comes to the economy and geopolitics, is also at work when it comes to climate change.
You say on the very last page of the book, Alex, that the main impediment to radical change is the chronic weakness of the radical anti-capitalist left internationally. Do you see signs of that changing?
I think it isn't changing as quickly as I would like, as the Zizek quotation that you mentioned initially indicates. A crisis like this, well, it's also what Rahm Emanuel said, Obama's chief of staff, a crisis like this is too good to waste. In other words, when the everyday workings of the system are thrown into crisis, it's an opportunity to remake the system or to replace it with something better. So I think the crisis is a major opportunity for people who want to see an alternative to capitalism. The problem that we face is that the left of all sorts, including the more radical anti-capitalist left, suffered a lot of defeats in the last decades of the 20th century. And I think there's a kind of cycle that started with the protests at Seattle in 1999 that represents the beginning of a process of recovery. But the crisis has been moving more quickly than the recovery. But there's no point in complaining about... And this helps to explain what you also started off talking about, the extent to which the neoliberals are still setting the agenda. Certainly any component of the left, including the traditional social democratic left, has failed to set the agenda. But there's no point in complaining too much about this situation. We just have to do our best to speed up the process of recovery, to catch up with what's happening. And the motto of the book is a quotation from Lenin saying that we have to be as radical as capitalism. And that seems to be even more true now than when I wrote the book.
Alex Kalinikos. Bonfire of Illusions is available now from Polity in paperback. If you go to the website at polity.co.uk, you'll find full details about the book there, as well as Alex's backlist. I hope you'll join me again soon for another Polity podcast. And until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.